John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 1st, 2010. Israeli troops abducted two Palestinian brothers and settlers attacked another house in the West Bank city of Hebron. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli troops broke into the home of a Tamimi family, searched it, and abducted two brothers on Wednesday morning. The two were identified as Bilal and Muad Tamimi, and their house is adjacent to the Israeli settlement of Kiryat Arba. Meanwhile, dozens of Israeli settlers threw stones and empty bottles at the house of Yunis Idris, also close to Kiryat Arba. Idris told media that at least 50 settlers took part in the assault, adding that the Israeli police arrived after the assailant settlers put the garden on fire. Idris also said that the police prevented the settlers from putting all the house on fire as they were trying to throw cooking gas jars inside the house, which would have killed all those inside the house. The settlers left behind the serious damage to the property and the furniture of the house. The settlers' attacks come shortly after unknown gunmen opened fire at Israeli settlers near Hebron on Tuesday evening, killing four of them. In other news, Palestinian security forces spotted a group of settlers gathering in the evacuated settlement of Homish near Jenin on Wednesday morning. According to the source, the settlers are accompanied by a number of Israeli soldiers. The settlement of Homish was evacuated in 2005 as part of the unilateral disengagement plan, during which Israel withdrew all Israeli settlers and army from the Gaza Strip and evacuated four small settlements in the West Bank. The settlers and the military constantly come to the area, although structures were demolished during the evacuation. Today's gathering is believed to be related to the attack against the settlers near Hebron on Tuesday, and with statements made by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu following the attack, in which he said that no settlement freeze will be declared in the West Bank. The Palestinian Authority security forces arrested on Wednesday at least 300 members of the rival Hamas party after the latter's armed wing claimed responsibility for the killing of four Israeli settlers Tuesday night in Hebron. Local sources reported that the Palestinian security forces entered homes and workplaces, arresting anyone they suspected of being connected to the Hamas party. The crackdown on Hamas comes as the Palestinian leadership heads to Washington for face-to-face negotiations with Israel, during which they must prove that they have full control over the West Bank. The resumption of direct talks in Washington comes after a freeze of 20 months due to Israel's lack of compliance with the signed agreements with the Palestinian Authority, especially the freeze of settlement activities in the West Bank, which is changing facts on the ground and will have a great impact on the results of final status negotiations. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. Been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and George Lishmael.
President Barack Obama says combat in Iraq is over, but that's been said before. Assyria, Iraq, yesterday. One U.S. Army vehicle was damaged Tuesday when a bomb exploded, targeting a U.S. convoy in southern Assyria, according to the media spokesman of the U.S. Army.
It's time to turn the page.
Basra, Iraq, Saturday. A roadside bomb hit a U.S. patrol. U.S. forces cordon off the area. No report on casualties. Wait a minute, U.S. patrol? But I thought...
Now, it's time to turn the page.
Amara, Iraq, Sunday. A U.S. soldier was injured by sniper fire while touring reconstruction projects. At least we can be thankful it wasn't combat related.
It's time to turn the page.
Basra, Iraq, Sunday. Two mortar rounds slammed into the green zone late Sunday. No casualties were reported. Mr. Barack Obama said combat operations in Iraq are over, but tell that to the people dodging these mortars and rockets.
To turn the page.
All U.S. war objectives in Iraq were defeated except for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein.
To turn the page.
Exxon and BP are not allowed to own Iraqi oil fields.
To turn the page.
The radical free trade and privatization experiment proposed by Paul Wolfowitz died under fire in summer 2003 as fired Sunni workers joined insurgent groups.
To turn the page.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq did not exist before the war, and unlike U.S. combat troops, is not even pretending to leave Iraq.
To turn the page.
Muqtada al-Sadr is unarrested and his Mahdi army is unbeaten and unbowed.
To turn the page.
Lastly, Mr. President, there is no stable government in Iraq 5 months after a Florida 2000-style election. Speaking of turning the page, U.S. casualties in Afghanistan are skyrocketing. Do you propose to follow the same surge model that produced continuing civil war in Iraq in Afghanistan, too? Helmand Province, Afghanistan, Monday. Five American soldiers were killed by an IED attack, according to news reports in the NATO. Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of three additional NATO soldiers in two IED attacks. Afghanistan, Tuesday. NATO is reporting the deaths of three occupation soldiers from a roadside bombing and a fourth occupation soldier in a separate IED attack. NATO is reporting the death of one occupation soldier in Afghanistan today and one yesterday in insurgent attacks. Lahore, Pakistan, today. Sunni fighters attacked Shiites, killing 28 people. In response, rioters then targeted police with sticks. Mr. Barack Obama, history has proven that the surge model didn't work in Iraq and won't work in Afghanistan. The time is now to pull the plug on the imperial ambitions of George W. Bush. Bring all the troops home today, combat and non-combat alike.
And no amount of money you could give me all.
Protests at the homes of corporate criminals aren't just for those who torture animals anymore. On the 22nd of August, members of Code Pink showed up at the home of Blackwater's founder, Eric Prince. They were there to demand that he stay in the U.S. to face criminal charges for the infamous Nisour Square shootings, where his men murdered 17 innocent civilians in Baghdad back in 2007. The protest began with the delivery of a letter to the home, which was thought to be empty due to rumors that Eric Prince had fled to the United Arab Emirates.
All right, so here I'm going to put this up on Eric Prince's door, and this is a letter from the new company called Pinkwater. Dear Eric Prince, on behalf of U.S. taxpayers, we say shame on you. Through your company Blackwater, or Z, as you now like to call it, stole hundreds of millions of dollars. Your employees also killed innocent civilians in Iraq, and you should be held responsible. Don't run away to the Emirates to escape prosecution. Stay here in the USA and face the consequences of your actions like a good Christian.
That would be, yeah.
Sincerely, Pinkwater.
Ms. Pinkwater.
It turned out that at least Eric Prince's family was still there. At first, they invited Medea Benjamin into the house, only to turn around and demand that she leave, physically assault her, and then charge her with trespassing and have her arrested after being invited into the home when Miss Prince realized this was about Blackwater's crimes. Here's what it sounded like when Miss Prince decided to physically push Medea Benjamin out the door as she was attempting to leave under her own power.
I'm getting pushed out here.
Whoa.
So Eric Prince's family is actually here. They haven't left for the Emirates. They are all inside. We sat there and waited for the police to come because she said she'd called the police. And I just wanted to make sure that the police knew that we didn't trespass. We were asked to leave and left. And instead, she had me arrested.
A homeowner's authority to come out and talk to you.
They still have called us. It may not be the homeowners, but the people at the house have called us and told us that we have to come up here and make sure you guys
get out. Well, she said get out of
need your IDs. Really.
She said get out of our house.
Yeah.
So
it's okay.
She never said get off the property, though.
Your ID in the car. Can you find it for me real quick, please?
So I was released from jail after 5 hours. This is the complaint that was filed by Joanna Prince, the wife of Eric Prince, and it accuses me of trespassing or remaining on the property of Joanna Prince after having been forbidden to do so by an authorized individual. I had to put up $500 for a bond.
Remember, Blackwater's founder, Eric Prince, is looking at facing criminal charges for allowing his mercenaries to shoot down 17 men, women, and children at Nisour Square, the youngest being 9-year-old Ali Kanani. Yet he and his wife have the nerve to charge someone with trespassing after being invited into their home. It's Eric Prince who should be posting bail, or maybe not, since he's clearly a flight risk. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink was arrested for trespassing in a place in which she had been invited, unlike U.S. troops or mercenaries in Iraq. Hey, Eric Prince, you stinking water buffalo turd. Remember, in D.C., in the United States, and in Iraq, there's no sleep for the wicked. Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
As news from the increasingly deadly war in Afghanistan gets worse, President Obama, in an Oval Office address to the nation, announced the end of combat operations in Iraq, a war that he pledged to end during his 2008 campaign for the White House. While Obama highlighted the reduction of U.S. troops from 144,000 when he took office in January 2009 to 50,000 today, the drawdown comes at a time of escalating violence and the failure of political parties to form a new government after national elections in March. The troop withdrawal does not include 95,000 private military contractors, with the U.S. State Department planning to increase the number of security contractors working for them in Iraq. The price paid for the war launched by President Bush in 2003 is astronomical, with almost 4,500 U.S. troops killed, tens of thousands wounded, and more than 100,000 Iraqis estimated to have thus far lost their lives in the seven-year war, with a monetary cost of more than $700 billion. While the U.S. invasion, originally tied by President Bush to weapons of mass destruction and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, brought down the brutal regime of Saddam Hussein, the quality of life for average Iraqis has not improved. More than a decade of economic sanctions, war, and occupation has smashed Iraq's infrastructure, resulting in a lack of basic services, including inadequate electricity and high unemployment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who discusses the significance of the end of U.S. combat operations in Iraq and the current agenda of the U.S. peace movement.
Well, it certainly is a step in the right direction, but I'm concerned about the continued very large footprint that we have. 50,000 troops is nothing to sneeze at. It's a lot of troops, and they're still going to be involved in dangerous activities, being potentially killed and killing. And then there are the tens of thousands of contractors, private contractors, that will continue to be there, the largest bases ever, five enduring bases, and the largest embassy ever in the world, the size of the Vatican. So our presence will still be very prominent, but it is a step in the right direction, and we have to keep pushing. It might occur that if there is indeed an Iraqi government at some point, they might ask the U.S. to stay longer, and we have to be prepared to be pushing President Obama and the Congress to say no.
And Medea, what shape is the United States leaving the Iraqi people as we draw down the number of troops there?
We have destroyed a country that had been living under 13 years of brutal sanctions and under a brutal dictatorship. And things are worse now than they were when the U.S. entered. People have less electricity, less clean drinking water, a health care system that before the sanctions was the envy of the Arab world and has now been decimated. Iraq, unbeknownst to most Americans, had one of the highest educational levels in the world and certainly in the Arab world. So it was an extremely educated society, and now the educational system is in tatters. That's not even to bring up the refugee situation, where there are at least 4 million Iraqi refugees living in desperate circumstances in Syria and Jordan and Lebanon and all around the world, and internally displaced over a million Iraqis as well. So we have really destroyed that country.
What do you see the role of the peace movement in this current period where, if things go according to what the articulated plans are, a troop withdrawal in Iraq while we see a simultaneous escalation of the war in Afghanistan? What do you think the peace movement should be doing now, given it's been fairly quiet since Barack Obama was elected?
I think we have to put the two wars together. First, we were so focused on Iraq that we forgot Afghanistan. Now we're focused on Afghanistan, and we're some people going along with the narrative that the war in Iraq has ended. Put them together and talk about the wars, because that also includes what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan and the drone bombs that are happening in other places as well. And to say that we have to stop these aggressive wars, that we have to put it in the context of the U.S. financial crisis, if we really want to speak to what most Americans are concerned about and say we cannot rebuild our economy, we can't have money for our schools and our healthcare system and our infrastructure and the green energy system we need to build if we continue to spend so many billions of dollars on war. And so this new campaign that's been called Bring Our War Dollars Home is being launched in cities and states around this country, and I think it's a very exciting time to make alliances. We've been talking about for 8 or 9 years now, but haven't done a good job at building. The peace movement has tended to be white and older. And October 2nd, there is a mobilization not called by the peace movement. It's actually called by the unions and the civil rights organizations, NAACP, SEIU, National Council of La Raza, the U.S. Student Association, to call for jobs, jobs, jobs. And we have asked to be part of this and to bring in the message of bring the war dollars home so that we can have jobs, jobs, jobs. And it's been an interesting process because we have had to fight to get the language against the war into the call, partially because many of these groups don't want to go against the Obama administration's policies, and partly because many union members who have jobs that are related to the war industry. We're very excited being part of the building for October 2nd. It's going to be bigger than Glenn Beck rally in Washington, and it's going to be led by people of color in the social justice movement. And we are determined that the issue of money for jobs, not for war, be included in it.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the groups Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. Contact Code Pink by calling area code 415-575-5555 or visit their website at codepinkalert.org.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
In Salisbury, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, someone shot up a Republican Party field office. The cops found the front glass door smashed and thought it was routine vandalism, according to the Washington Post. They thought that until they looked inside and found a bullet in the walls. If smashing glass doors is routine vandalism of GOP field offices and party headquarters, that sounds to me like some insurgents here in the U.S. have really had enough of the venom flowing from GOP hate mongers like Glenn Beck and all his racist pro-war friends. Bullets through the door, is points on the board, so maybe the GOP and their teabagger friends are not as popular as they thought. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio@hushmail.com.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
On the 28th of August, notorious Tea Party leader Glenn Beck staged a rally at the Lincoln Memorial on the 47th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. There was a smattering of confrontations between anti-racist activists and the followers of Beck and Sarah Palin, and at least two cases where people were assaulted by teabaggers. One photographer was punched in an effort to damage his camera, and another woman was scratched up by an assault from a teabagger.
We just arrived, and I held up my sign.
Uh-huh.
A lady with a Restoring Honor t-shirt came up and scratched him and then pulled the sign up.
And can I see the scratches?
Sure, right here.
Now, is that woman, did she, like, take off? Is she still
she
around?
She left, yeah.
She left.
She took on a hump. Up there.
Yeah, in a hump.
She took a, but she attacked you.
Well, I don't say it was attack, but she...
Well, I would say scratches on your arm is an attack. I mean, that's pretty severe.
Oh, it's not a comfortable situation.
Yeah, I would think not. That's an assault.
In the afternoon, Al Sharpton's Reclaim the Dream marched on the mall in opposition to the teabaggers.
Well, one, let me just get your general impression of what today's gathering was about and what you hope to accomplish.
Well, it's about standing on the shoulders of all the saints who from their labors rest, particularly those who came to Washington 300,000 strong 47 years ago. And we must now reconvene that coalition of conscience and expand it to people all over the world who are suffering because of the greed and the opportunism of the rich. And I'm looking forward to seeing this movement take off as never before.
Let me ask you one quick question. From a left perspective, some have been a little bit critical of this gathering as being more about a reaction to the Tea Party than about advancing the political, social, and collective cultural struggle of black people in this country, as was the original charge in 63. How would you respond to that?
Well, we are advancing the cause of black people and our heritage because they have not given up. We are from the most resource-rich planet, continent on the planet, and they still are resolved to deny us income, education, healthcare, housing, and justice. And we must lead a world that is becoming increasingly impoverished, wiping out the middle class, not simply with AIDS and other diseases, but also with the concentration of the wealth of the world into the hands of about 2% of the people. And so I am hopeful that those who were financed to come here to hijack the memorial and to use it against our struggle have been answered and are going to be challenged as never before as a result of what I feel among the people here who decided that they weren't there 47 years ago. But God knows they're going to do their job now.
Justice! Now! Justice! Now! Justice! Now! Justice! Now!
Power! How you doing, sir?
Power!
Jared Ball, WPFW and BlackAgendaReport.com. Just wanted to ask you all, what does justice mean in 2010? When you're calling for it, what does it mean nowadays?
just says right now in this year, based on what's going on, we're wondering what it means. Everybody's trying to neglect our constitutional rights on something that we fought and died for. We have the color of the land. These colors we're flying is red, black, and green is the blood that we end up suffering for. The black is the people and the green is the land. That's why we're actually flying these colors, based on reclaiming this dream that we have some people out there now trying to end up tearing down what we actually have died for.
Just asking folks why you all came out today and what you feel about the event, what you hope to see come out of it, and is it living up to your expectations?
Well, I'm an educator here in Washington, D.C., in the southeast portion of the district.
Reed didn't get rid of you yet?
No. Oh, you cannot get rid of this teacher. I work for the Maya Angelou Public Charter School. And the reality is, as an educator, I have to be conscious of the events that are going on that are affecting the children in my community. That's why we encourage children to come out to the event. We are so happy that we see youth here. I definitely feel that the event is fulfilling its dream, and its dream is marching down 6th Street right now, all the way towards the National Mall. So we're excited to see the non-ending, never-ending line of folks behind us, and we're just ecstatic to be here.
At the 29th of August, Hemp City, across 42 at 7th and R Street Northwest, marked 7 weeks in existence, having been here since the 10th of June. This place has taken over, opened quite affordable housing, Hemp City, on the 10th of June. The people sleeping in these tents at night. We've got people actively maintaining the property. This long grass is being cut down again. It's like any lawn, it has to be periodically cut down. Get the gardening tools out. 1DC is pulling entirely out of the tent city, pulling some tents down. But homeless folks who've actually been staying at the tent city, from what I hear, are going to be staying on. That what started as a symbolic takeover by 1DC is now morphing almost entirely into an occupation of Parcel 42 by people who literally have no place else to sleep. Okay, so what's going to be the situation for homeless people who are actually sleeping in this park as 1DC pulls out?
Well, with or without 1DC, the homeless have rights in this city. The Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless puts out these laminated flyers that explain the homeless rights, and on those flyers it says that the homeless do have the right to sleep in public places as long as they're not on federal property. And so with this not being federal property, they can't be removed. And furthermore, it's my understanding that DC's property laws, as they pertain to property owned by DC government, only protect buildings, not vacant
and
lots.
And there's no building here. And what of the promise that it would be a 14-day notice to vacate before anybody could be evicted from here? Will that still apply when the homeless are here without an NGO?
Well, the way that happens is that someone in the neighborhood has to complain first. And then if somebody in the neighborhood complains, then a woman named Patricia Handy, who works for Department of Human Services, will be contacted, and she'll come out here and post a 14-day notice. And after 14 days, they'll come in with the Department of Public Works, or basically a garbage truck, and they'll tear everything down and throw it in the back of the garbage truck.
Can we guarantee that the homeless will have the same rights that 1DC had with respect to Parcel 42?
Well, their rights will be protected. There are lawyers who will fight for the homeless. So long as the homeless know who to go to, then their rights will be fought for. And the ACLU has actually won several cases across the country where homeless people's possessions were disposed of illegally, illegal search and seizure. There was a class action in Miami where every homeless person got $1,500 if their stuff was disposed of by the police and the sanitation workers. And then there was a case in California, Fresno, California, where the homeless received like $10,000 apiece.
All right, I see that these two tents, I see two tents here, one and two, that are staying up. I assume that these are the tents along with the pavilion that people are going to be sleeping in.
Yes. What the black tent belongs to a married couple, and they are homeless. This tent city was arranged mainly by people who are not homeless, but the ones living in the black tent are actually homeless. The blue and gray tent is mine. I stay at 2nd and D, but the rules there are I can be gone two nights a week. And also, I'm allowing some other people to use my tent because there's a certain woman who was staying at the John L. Young Women's Shelter. And over there, even if you have a job, but you're working less than 20 hours a week, they won't reserve your bed for you. So she got some work working with the Redskins, doing some, I don't know what she's doing, but she's working the games. And she's not doing 20 hours a week, so they won't reserve her bed for her. And so she was actually sleeping in my tent after getting off work, because when she got back to the shelter, her bed was already taken.
Ah, because there ain't enough beds to go around. Same old story, eh?
Well, there aren't enough beds, and the shelter will reserve your bed for you if you work at least 20 hours a week.
Which means somebody's got to be willing to hire you. Which means somebody's got to be willing to hire you for that. And what if the Washington football team that has not even one home game a week going to do with 20 hours a week?
Exactly, right. And so that was her predicament. And so because she was going to work, she was losing her shelter bed. And
that's actually a very
common problem amongst the homeless community, is that oftentimes you have to choose between working and having a bed to sleep in. And so, you know.
Ah, yes, the cycle of perpetual homelessness.
Exactly.
1DC has pulled out of the tent city on parcel 42 on the 29th of August, but the homeless are staying on. These homeless people are actually sleeping here. They don't have any place else to go and do need this tent city as a place to sleep. We still got the pavilion, and we still got two tents that people are actually sleeping in. And Mayor Fenney, don't even think about treating homeless people who sleep here different than you treated 1DC. Don't even think about it.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life, each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes, and when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station. Where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway. On the 30th of August, hundreds of fed-up Pepco customers in Montgomery County packed into a Rockville public hearing, some demanding that Pepco be fined for future failures to fix storm outages in a timely manner. Pepco made the poorly maintained power lines, some of them green with corrosion, that cut power to the slightest bad weather, but as Chesapeake Climate Action Network pointed out at the hearing, global warming from burning coal, oil, and gas made the storms themselves, the three thunderstorms and a blizzard, yielding four protracted outages in less than a year.
frustrations of citizens from Senator Sand in Atlanta. Enough from the outset has lasted too long. We're talking repeated out of this, but essentially he admitted it over and over and over again. Letters of people who have been out of power repeatedly over this year alone. 14, 13 days.
Mike Tidwell of Chesapeake Climate Action Network and some of his friends started outside the hearing holding signs and went in to testify concerning the impact of global warming on electrical reliability.
I see signs about extreme weather, it's bigger than Pepco, and no reliable power without clean energy.
Yes, that's true.
How much do you think Pepco's own coal burning has contributed to the weather that has been taken out their grid?
Pepco's responsible for burning dirty energy, but for the most part, the extreme weather we're seeing is because of a combination of global emissions, not just Pepco, and not just bad Pepco service.
Yes, it took 150 years of all coal-burning utilities put together to make the storms that are knocking down the power lines. But it also took Pepco's sloppy maintenance to make the power lines so vulnerable. I've looked up at power lines, seeing wires green with corrosion, with no insulation left on them, just waiting for the tiniest piece of wet tree branch to short them out. If, as Mike Tidwell says, Pepco's storm repair record is no worse than that of other utilities, that just means the problems we're having here with Pepco's sloppy maintenance are repeated in utilities all over the United States. And CCAN did say that Pepco's record on day-to-day outages is among the worst in the industry.
Our lights keep going out in the Pepco region, primarily because our weather is changing. I mean, we've had just extreme storms, unprecedented record storms, both for snow, rainfall, wind speeds, and it fits a pattern that climate scientists say is linked to global warming. There's all kinds of data showing that extreme precipitation patterns are changing in the east, that we're getting more extreme precipitation, that even snowfall is increasing because there's more moisture in a warmer atmosphere.
So what does that have to do with Pepco?
There is no data whatsoever showing that Pepco is any better or worse at restoring power after extreme storms than any other utility in the country.
Of course, all that means is that all the other utilities are letting their wires turn into a green corroded mess too, and that means no matter where you live, you better look out, because the same rotten service we get from Pepco is coming to you too. If global warming means we're always going to be getting blizzards and furious thunderstorms, that means it's more important than it ever was before to bury those power lines, as well as burying the coal habit that made the storms in the first place.
More trees are falling. It's not our imagination that more trees are falling. They are falling. Our weather's more extreme. It's linked to trends in global warming, and we need to address more than just Pepco's utility trucks. We need to address the issue of fossil fuels, burning oil, coal, and natural gas.
And Pepco, or should I say Pepcoal, don't even think about using Chesapeake Climate Action Network statistics about the past year's brutal weather as an excuse for more of the same and doing nothing. If CCAN is right, this brutal weather is here to stay, and now more than ever, you've got to bury those power lines. And this proof of global warming means now more than ever, you got to stop using that mountaintop removal coal that is destroying our Earth. The last day of August, animal rights protesters continued the siege of Fortress, entering the buildings containing both Goldman Sachs and Nomura, both major stockholders in Fortress Inc., the company that kept monkey torturing Huntington Life Sciences from going bankrupt with over $100 million in loans.
Rudy Goldman, we are here once again because of your involvement with the Huntington Life Sciences. Goldman Sachs, we have issued a letter stating that you need to drop all ties with Fortress.
Sir, you don't understand.
Security got a little pushy at Goldman Sachs, not only inside the building, but also out on the sidewalk.
Any meeting! So we are here, outside your offices! We have been at your executive home! We will never back down, Goldman Sachs, until you sever all ties with Fortress, which is the life support system of Huntington Life Sciences!
Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing facility that murders 500 animals each and every day of the week. They've been exposed in seven separate...
When protesters were finished with Goldman Sachs at 101 Constitution Avenue, they went down the road to 701 Pennsylvania Avenue, home of Bayer and AstraZeneca, both customers of puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences.
Good morning, Bayer and AstraZeneca. We're back.
Which owns 15% of Fortress, whose loans are the reason Huntington Life Sciences still exists.
Nomura! We are here because you are top owners of Fortress.
Fortress kept Huntington Life Sciences alive with $100 million in loans.
Punching beagle puppies in the face, dissecting live primates, and mutilating rabbits to the highest bidder. Nomura, you have the ability to divest from Fortress Investments, therefore ending the lifeline to Huntington Life Sciences and stopping the madness inside of their walls. Nomura, you need to do the right thing. You need to end HLS. 500 animals died today!
No! It's too bad!
500 animals suffered in pain.
You heard that, Goldman Sachs and Nomura, AstraZeneca and Bayer, dump Huntington Life Sciences, because in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked.
While President Obama and top administration officials tout the safety of eating Gulf seafood in the wake of the massive BP oil spill, a new study by scientists from the Natural Resources Defense Council, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, raises concerns over long-term concentration of toxins in Gulf shrimp, oysters, crabs, and other invertebrates. These species have trouble flushing out polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, which are cancer-causing agents in oil and other fossil fuels. The seafood industry in the Gulf of Mexico produces two-thirds of the oysters eaten in the United States and is a major hub for shrimp and crab. Moreover, trace amounts of cadmium, mercury, and lead are present in crude oil and can accumulate in large fin fish like tuna and mackerel. On August 10th, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, reopened over 5,000 square miles of the Gulf to fishing, leaving 22% of the Gulf closed. According to Mother Jones magazine, environmental groups have called on the Obama administration to impose strict testing protocols to make sure Gulf seafood is safe to eat in the years to come.